Joining us for this edition of Track Record on Share Radio is the entrepreneur and branding and marketing expert, Nadim Sadegh. Nadim founded Sadegh Weinberg Research back in the 1990s, later sold to WPP. He conducted research for development of brands and communications for many of the world's largest blue-chip organizations, Unilever, Bacardi, Kimberly-Clark, Vodafone and Sony Ericsson amongst them. He later bought an island and developed a brand around that, the Inish Turk Beg brand. And he's now CEO at brand management consultancy Transgressive X, based in London. Nadim, that's quite a list. A warm welcome to Track Record on Share Radio. It's nice to have you along.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little of your background, perhaps starting with your early ambitions. Did the boy Nadim have those? And which direction were you looking when you were much younger?
That's a deeply probing question, and it goes straight to my megalomania. I'm half Irish and half Egyptian, and I remember thinking as a 10-year-old that I really ought to be president of both countries simultaneously. So I had very lofty ambitions, quickly knocked out of me, thank goodness, by life and wisdom.
Did you see a life ahead in business, perhaps? Business and commerce?
My upbringing was actually as the youngest son of a World Health Organization statistician. So he was an international civil servant, my father, and my mother was an Irish teacher. And we traveled the world essentially doing good for the health of the world. And entrepreneurism and enterprise generally were not really the sorts of things which flourished in my home. It was much more discussion of politics and civil rights and those sorts of things. So actually, business came pretty late.
Nonetheless, politics and civil rights and everything else that you've hinted there, the fact that you were growing up with that background, that discourse going on around you, that seems pretty fertile, really.
It was, yeah. I was lucky enough to be exposed to so many different cultures in Africa, in Asia and in the Caribbean in particular, and then of course I went to school in Dublin, that eventually I began to see the way the world works, and trade and commerce is at the heart of very much of it. So I increasingly took an interest in that, and I think luckily I was able to bring to bear some of my cultural sensitivity from around the world.
We'll talk about your career as we go, of course, on Track Record on Share Radio. It's as much musical chat as CV chat, though, Nadim, and we start with Schaefer and Monster. Can you tell me why this makes your list?
Schaefer is an artist who I manage. I've been involved in the music business for a while. I produced another couple of albums, and I've been Schaefer's manager for a few years. And she is a mesmerizing artist with a beautiful voice and a really interesting insight into mental health and relationships and things like that. And this Monster track, I think, really subtly and beautifully deals with the way we've all got things going on in our heads, and those of us who are at peace tend to understand all of them and just live with them.
I've made mistakes, don't want to face them. As you appear, I can't erase them. Are you ready? Start the fight. Tunnels end, is no light. There are weaknesses in you. She'll fight them right on cue. Start beneath my bed, then crawl into my head. You're a monster. The way you made me feel, in ways that I can't heal. You're a monster. You're a monster. So she drags me into the arena, but she's in there. I don't want to meet her. She knows I'm powerless, I'm weak.
Schaefer. and Monster. This is Track Record on Share Radio, and this week our guest alongside is Nadeem Sadek, who joins us for the chat and for the music as well, choosing first up on the list Shafri's Monster. Now, for someone who has extensive pedigree in market research and branding, you talked there just ahead of that piece of music about this diversion into music management. Why have you gone off down that route recently?
Some time ago in my life, I realised that having learnt a variety of languages as a child, all not terribly well, but Yoruba and Malaysian and a few other kind of more popular languages, I understood pretty quickly that music is the lingua franca of the world. And it covers people and allows them to interact in a way which articulation and verbal concepts don't. So I got really interested in music, and I was lucky enough, having lived all over the place, to have been exposed to many different types. I'm pretty wide-tasted in my musical repertoire. And I was asked to do a program a while ago in Ireland, and I ended up benefacting a musical charity, which I saw bringing those who were socially underprivileged, if you like, into much more positive life paths. And it all happened because they were into music and were facilitated in music, and I've stuck with it. And the more that I stuck with it, the more I understood that really musical artists and bands and acts are brands just as much as anybody else. So I began to think that actually I could probably play a part in the development of a musical brand, and that's what I do.
So not so far away from your marketing background anyway.
No, it's a hideously complicated industry, but it's actually the same concepts of you know, developing a brand with a proposition that people like and then activating it in a way that they can access.
Well, let's talk on market research and the work that you've done in that and in the branding industry over the last 30 or more years. What originally sparked this interest for you?
I'm going to sound like I'm being facetious all the time, but when I was in university and I was studying pure psychology, I looked at my career paths, which were things like forensic psychology, which scared me, child development, which I didn't find myself fascinated by, educational psychology, and so on. And I thought, what thesis can I write that gets me out of all this really difficult stuff? And I happened upon a phrase which was psychology for sale. And I thought, this is quite clever. And I wrote that phrase down. It was probably the best thing in my thesis. And that took me to meet market research companies which owned brands, and advertising agencies, because they all thought, well, here's a chap who's just gone through the latest psychological discourses and understands how to employ psychology for sale. Let's talk to him. And I accidentally, therefore, ended up in a very commercial take on psychology, which is market research.
Are you still very much interested in how the mind works in this respect?
Yes. In fact, I've kind of been reinvigorated with that in the last 5 years or so, because I took a break from market research. And when I came back, I decided that I wanted to try to understand and use as much as possible the advances in neuroscience and indeed in measurement technology. So that's what Transgressive X does. It collides those things.
Let's hear your next track record choice, which is a French-Canadian track. Tell us about it and why you've chosen it.
My sister lives in France, and as a child, she's older than I am, and as a child I used to go and spend some of my holidays with her. And this was an artist that she asked me to listen to, a French-Canadian, and he sings just the most joyful track, as you'll hear, called I Went to the Market, and it's a song sung half in French and half in English, which describes the flirtation between this chap and the daughter of a lawyer, and how daughters of lawyers always are. It's just a happy-making song.
I went to the market, mon petit panier sous mon bras. I went to the market, mon petit panier sous mon bras. The first girl I met, c'est la fille d'un avocat. I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère. I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas.
I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère. I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas.
The first girl I met, c'est la fille d'un avocat. The first girl I met, c'est la fille d'un avocat. She said, what have you got dans ce beau petit panier là? I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère.
I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas.
said, what have you got dans ce beau petit panier là? She said, what have you got dans ce beau petit panier là? I have got some eggs, n'en achèteriez-vous pas? I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère. I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas. Some eggs, non, achèteriez-vous pas? I have got some eggs, non, achèteriez-vous pas? I'll take 2 dozen, puis one te paiera ça. I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère. I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas.
I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère. I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas.
I'll take 2 dozen, puis le bonhomme te paiera ça. I'll take 2 dozen, puis le bonhomme te paiera ça. I gave her 2 dozen, mais le bonhomme n'y payait pas. I love you, vous ne m'entendez guère. I love you, vous ne m'entendez pas.
Gilles Vignon, I went to the market. This is Track Record on Share Radio, and we're talking on this edition with Nadeem Sadek, whose background is very much in market research and the branding industry. Transgressive X, his current company, is where he's focusing his energies at the moment. Well, come on, we'll talk about that a little later. But first up, some years ago, you co-founded Sadek Winberg Research back in the 1990s, which I understand, Nadeem, soon became the biggest organisation of its sort before you eventually sold it on. Tell me about the founding of the company and how it came about.
I've had so many experiences of life accidentally offering you opportunities, and Sadek Winberg Research was one of those. I was working in a boutique qualitative market research agency that was absolutely fantastic. It was too hectic for a sustainable life once I had my first and then second child. And to be candid, I looked for a way out to find easier working hours. And that led me to deciding that I should just found my own little market research company. And I met Rebecca Weinberg, who at the time was the MD of a very well-known and big and prosperous market research company. And we just hit it off. You know, I'm an Irish Egyptian, and she was a South African Jewish girl, and it all seemed a bit improbable for lots of reasons, but we actually just collided and coalesced very well. And between us, we created an interesting and very good market research agency, which we're both very proud, and it prospered and flourished for about 10 years, and we then felt it was the right moment to sell it to WPP. Mm.
We'll talk more about that in a moment or two, but how relatively experienced were you at the point where you said, you know what, the easiest way of doing this is to do it myself?
I was in my 30s, and I was very high mileage for my age. I think I'd done a lot more than I really ought to have done by then. So I wasn't naive about what was required. And actually, the qualitative market research industry had, particularly at that time, very low barriers to entry. You know, you just needed a pencil and a piece of paper and a cassette recorder, and you could go and make some money. And indeed, we were cash flow positive within our first month of operation. So I think it was a knowing entrepreneurial decision, driven by a kind of parallel personal desire just to have an easier life.
And to make it fit. Into other areas of your life, as you've hinted as well. Do you think that we, most of us, get to that point in our careers, whatever we do?
I think so. I'm a great believer in aphorisms. I'm finding as I get older that I love more and more the old, you know, sayings like a stitch in time saves nine and so on. One which I have come to understand, I wouldn't quite say I've invented it, but I say it, is that it costs a lot to earn a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think the kind of the equation that, you know, we all run past ourselves, you know, is it actually worth doing this? It's a sensible one to revisit periodically.
Do you look back now on your years when it was Sadek Winberg Research, and can you see now very clearly where the successes were?
Yes, I can. I think we had some principles of operation which were really good and quite avant-garde at the time. I mean, the really good ones were simply that we devoured excellence. We always wanted excellence. So we set ourselves high standards rather than just kind of volume that made money as a target. we said that we would always employ people and reward them sufficiently that they never felt they wanted to set up their own businesses in, as I've said, this very low barrier to entry industry. So we kind of overpaid them relative to the marketplace. And we set up systems which were strange, like we had relational databases, which meant that the people who added value to clients' work were not sort of mired in daily administration, which can be quite taxing in qualitative market research. So we freed people to do their jobs, we rewarded them well, and we set really high standards. And those things actually led to wealth and relaxation. It was a great formula.
Who did you work with? At that time, which brands, which organisations were you working with?
Our clients were very broad-ranging, but I remember in particular that we became favourites with Unilever, where we developed a lot of their brands and a lot of their communication strategies. Also with Kimberly-Clark, I remember working on Huggies and Kleenex and Andrex and a load of other brands like that extensively. We helped Bacardi Global Brands, which was just sort of forming out of the collision of Bacardi and Martini companies at that point. Coca-Cola. I mean, it was, you know, many of the very well-known brands, plus working on lots of smaller things like Speedo, which I remember doing an underwater commercial evaluation on, which was great fun.
And what made you and your partner decide that it was time to sell up and move on?
I think we both started, you know, Sadek Weinberg Research fairly young. You know, we were in our 30s, and by the time we were in our early 40s, there wasn't much more that we could do except to keep getting bigger. And it was quite young to plateau in your kind of chosen field. So we thought that by realizing some of the value of the business through a sale, we would give ourselves personal choices about how we continued to operate that company, both personally and professionally, and also to make decisions about how to spend some of the rest of our time and whether we would be less involved in the business per se.
Let's hear your next track record choice. It's Khaled and Aisha. Tell us why this makes your list and why you've insisted that we play it today.
I'm very conscious that I don't speak Arabic terribly well, and that Middle Eastern music is pretty inaccessible, and particularly nowadays it's associated with lots of terrible things. But Khaled is an Algerian musician who has written a beautiful love song in both French and Arabic, and I listen to it and just love the kind of Middle Eastern nuances in music, all the tones which are uniquely from that region.
Je n'existais pas. Elle est passée à côté de moi. Sans un regard, reine de Saba. J'ai dit Aïcha, prends tout est pour toi. Voici les perles, les bijoux.
Khaled with Aisha. This is Track Record on Share Radio, and Nadeem Sadek is alongside from Transgressive X.
I do keep saying that we'll come on and talk about that in a moment, but we certainly shall, Nadim. After aesthetic Weinberg research and selling it on and moving on from that, what came next for you?
Well, sort of inadvertently, I had a twin track that began with part of the kind of bag of swag that I picked up through the sale. I bought an island off the west coast of Ireland, and I know that sounds crazy, and it was a bit, but that's what I did. And I was privately developing it as a kind of giant playground for me and my family and friends.
Is it right that you beat Ronan Keating in the bidding war for it?
Yes, that is said, and I believe it's true, although we've never met each other.
You don't have to give us the exact figure, but exactly how much does an island off the coast of Ireland retail for?
Well, that is a very good question, because it also led to my downfall financially in the end. But actually, it wasn't that expensive to buy. And by the end of my stewardship of it, it was extremely valuable. So how long is a piece of string, and who gets to measure it is a good question.
So tell me about the attraction of it then.
I have obviously been around the world, you know, at the same time as the island being bought and being developed, I had been asked to become the global CEO of a company called Millward Brown, and Millward Brown's Qualitative Network, which was the same sort of company as Sadek Weinberg, but many of them all around the world. And I did that for about 3 years. And when I came to the end of that tenure, I was then also asked to help to run a company called Research International, which actually was fascinating for me, because that was the whole business rather than just the qualitative part of it. And indeed, part of my brief was to try and reinvigorate the quantitative intellectual properties of that business. So in a weird way, many years after seeing my father being a brilliant statistician, I returned to numbers, or came to numbers, for the first time in my life. And that gave me some sort of sense of fulfillment. After doing that for a while, I therefore had a much more rounded perspective on what quantitative and qualitative businesses in the market research industry do. And I was falling out of love with the industry. I particularly was scathing about the forces against innovation and the kind of commercial imperatives not to change very much in order to keep the businesses going. And it just really wasn't for me to do anymore. So there I was, kind of feeling a bit dispirited professionally and rather excited personally with this island that kept getting sort of more and more exciting. And so I decided instead to practice what I'd preached for so long to my clients and go and develop my own brand. And I therefore switched all of my attentions and what resources I had and built a team to develop the Inish Turk Beg brand, as it was called. And that's what I went off and did.
And what was Inish Turk Beg?
Inish Turk Beg is the Irish, it's a slightly anglicised version of the Irish, I must confess, but it's the Irish.
Inish is our island, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. And Turk is a boar, and Beg is small. So it was the small island of the wild boar. And apart from being just the most beautiful place I'd ever seen, it's a stunning kind of Drumlin-esque island in the middle of an enclosed bay, surrounded by others, and with just amazing mountain ranges around it and beautiful sunsets. And
about as typically Irish as you can get.
It is. And it was very navigable water. I mean, it was a true island. We had to get to it by boat, but it wasn't terribly onerous or frightening. So it was exciting, but manageable. Anyway, what we did with the brand was we said that we were ultimately going to develop a single malt Irish whiskey that was going to be our hero product. And we would take various steps on the path to that destination. And what we did was develop the island's infrastructure so that we could have a hospitality business, which ultimately I envisaged becoming part of a kind of distillery visit, so to speak. And that got us some cash to keep things going. We developed a food brand, which was essentially smoked fish. And I used to joke to the buyers at Harrods and Harvey Nicks and a few other places where it retailed in London, for example, that I looked at every fish in the eye before I landed it and sold it to you, which always got a little laugh. You can give a little laugh now. There you go.
Bang on cue.
Thank you. And then we went from there to doing slightly more philanthropic stuff, although, of course, it was all part of, you know, building the DNA of an authentic brand. But I wanted to do art residencies, because I've always been okay with words, but I've always admired people who can create things, and I can't even draw. And so we got all these kind of mixed media artists to come along and spend a week on the island, and we, you know, wined and dined them and looked after them and gave them nice places to live. But essentially the transaction was, we'll look after you for a week, we'll let this place inspire you and create things which are somehow speaking of the island, and that will become an increasingly large set of artifacts that draw their inspiration from this place. And we did that, and it was absolutely wonderful. We had Japanese and Dutch and Swedish and all sorts of artists from around the world creating really different things, which we then put together in group shows in London and Dublin. So the art came along, and doing the art so successfully led me to think that actually, given my love of music, I should also do music. And we created what we called the Inish Turk Beg Sessions, which involved a whole pile of musicians coming to the island, where in effect we had recording studios, because the buildings were triple glazed Swedish designs, a couple of them, and they could easily work as kind of isolated areas. And they stayed for 2 weeks at a time and just created music. And we'd sometimes drink a bit of whiskey and get onto a boat, which I shouldn't really say, but we did. And we'd play the fiddle and flutes wandering around the bay in the middle of the night, and the neighbours wondered what on earth was going on this island. But it was an extremely creative, fertile, exciting time. And all of those things essentially gave us credibility as a brand, because we were creating, we were vigorous and inspired by the authenticity and the beauty of the place.
Fair play for building a brand around myth and legend and geography and history and just the sheer sense of place of such an area as well. And it sounds as if it was awfully good for your own soul as well, Nadim.
I loved it. I really felt at peace and productive and kind of worthwhile, which was nice.
You mentioned that connection with music, and we're never far from it, of course, on Track Record on Share Radio. Your next is Arrows, Hot, Hot, Hot. Now, here's a bit of a disco groover, if ever there was one. Why does this make your list?
Well, I was fortunate enough to live in Barbados for a while. my father was posted there, and my mother came to see me in Dublin when I was at university, and she'd hired a car, and I was driving it. And we were playing Hot, Hot, Hot on our cassette player. And she said, go on, dance. And so I was dancing the car around the road, which is ridiculous. And the police pulled me over and, you know, obviously lectured me fairly sternly. And my mother got out of the car and pleaded with them not to charge me for doing this, because she said that she had told me to do the limbo. And unbelievably, they laughed and let me off.
Olé!
Arrow with Hot, Hot, hot. Nadeem Sadek joins us on this edition of Track Record on Share Radio. And you've just been telling us about this marvelous experience of buying and transforming and making a brand out of an island just off the coast of your native Ireland. But you suggested earlier on that it kind of very nearly broke you as well. Can you tell me more?
Yeah. I remember thinking, as a child, I remember thinking, you know, I seem to be happy all the time. And later in life, I wondered whether good fortune could follow one forever, because I always seemed to be doing okay and always seemed to be happy. And I had, you know, a lovely home and beautiful children, and I was successful at work, and, you know, essentially in most material and emotional and spiritual things, I was content and wealthy. With the move from the kind of well-travelled market research groove that I'd been in to essentially creating a business that would have cash flow challenges as one invested in production of things, particularly whiskey, which takes time. I mean, it literally takes 3 years before you can even call it whiskey. So you sit on investments for quite a while before you can generate any cash. I had come to an arrangement with my bank. Interesting, you know, it is a bank with many parts and all sorts of services. And part of their spiel to me had always been that they would bring all these disparate parts together to serve my interests best. And it was easier just to deal with one place. So I did. And the agreement that we came to was that they would support me through the cash flow challenges, given that I had significant assets that they could rely upon. For a period of 5 years. None of us, I suppose, properly foresaw the financial crash that came. And about 2 years after that, they decided that they would renege on their agreement with me, indicating to me that it wasn't a contract, of course. So that was interesting. Meanwhile, fleeing into their disparate parts again, and each refusing to acknowledge that, you know, one part owed any allegiance to the undertakings of another part. So it was a very, very ugly transparency about banking, which I loathe in practice. And the net effect of it was that the holding company in which I had placed the ownership of the island was placed in receivership by one part of the bank, which essentially was just a house of cards then, that led to many other things falling apart, and a very significant diminution of my wealth was the result.
Had you much experience prior to this in other aspects of running a business? And had you gone into this very confident that this would all work out, that everything was in place? Or was this something of a shocking realization for you?
I don't know if I was... because things had always gone easily and well for me, I don't think I'd ever gone through the kind of the cauldron of having to save a business month after month from receivers or banks or creditors or anything else. So, you know, I don't think I was the fittest steward of a business that was under pressure. However, you know, I had built up with my partner the biggest business of its type in the world, and I had succeeded with each of the things that I was doing at Inishturk Beg, and I'd been part of, you know, the running of a business in 52 countries. I wasn't naive, I wasn't inexperienced, but there was something about me that was just too trusting, I think. I believed my advisors and I believed my bankers, that they would do the things that they said they would do, and quite simply, it wasn't true.
You strike me as a type, though, and I think this is deep down in all of us, that no matter how bad it gets, no matter how big a mistake we've made, there is something to be gained from it. There is something that you can find of use in that experience. And I wonder if it was the same for you. Was it enough for you to make you regroup, gather yourself, and do something different?
Again, one of those kind of age-old maxims, you know, necessity is the mother of invention came floating through my mind, and I just knew that I had to to regroup, as you say, and learn and improve, really. I mean, you know, either I had to kind of surrender and just say, right, I'm broken and I'm done, or I had to begin again. And I just never thought about surrendering, really. And I took as short a time as I could to decide what I would do next. And I knew that I couldn't do exactly what I'd done before because, as I've already described to you, I'd come to a plateau and there wasn't much more for me to do in the area that I'd previously been active. But remember, I also said that I'd been falling out of love with the industry. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see if I could reinvigorate my love for market research by not just disrupting it. You know, that's not satisfying per se, but through a disruption, through an innovation, through doing the things which I had found the businesses that I had created and worked for were no longer having the appetite to do. If I could do those things, I would feel proud. And I needed to feel that I was doing something really worthwhile, that was improving the service we offered clients and actually offering people coming into the industry careers that were more exciting and actually just doing higher caliber everything. So they were the standards that I set. And because of that kind of interaction with the quantitative, statistical part of market research that I'd had a few years earlier, and I suppose ultimately my father's influence on me through his amazing ability with numbers, I wanted to make it a statistically based, a quantitative business that employed neuroscience and was really contemporary. I wanted to build a SaaS model, to software as a service business, effectively. And that's what I set out to do, and that's what Transgressive X has become.
More in a moment. On Track Record on Share Radio. Next up on your chosen tracks is Lick the Tins and Can't Help Falling in Love. Your next musical choice. Why this one, Nadim?
I can't remember exactly when it was, but I'm sure we all remember The Commitments, the film coming out, and the follow-up, Roddy Dawes, sort of second book, perhaps. I don't know if it was second, but anyway, the next one was The Van. Mm. And one of my brothers-in-law was an assistant director on it, and they were looking for a bit of play-out music for the end of the film. And I had heard on the radio, I think, when I was driving through Kilburn, a track by a group called Lick the Tins. And as soon as I heard them, I could tell that they're strongly Irish, and I explored them a bit. And I think they were from Belfast, a solicitor and an accountant who played music in their spare time. And they just did this kind of fantastic take on an Elvis Presley classic, which I can't help getting going to when I hear it.
Men say
Can't Help Falling in Love from Lick the Tins. You're listening to Track Record on Share Radio. And alongside is Nadeem Sadek. You hinted there about the time being right and the space being right, I guess, at moving on to found what later became Transgressive XTX. And was the timing right then? Was the moment correct for you?
I think the fact that I had no choice, I mean, I suppose I could have gone and looked for a job, but I'm not sure that I'm cut out to be the best employee. So my choice was to create a new business. And as I've said, it was in an area that I felt I could offer something innovative and of added value to the industry and to the industry's clients.
And crucially, did you go back refreshed?
I did go back refreshed, yeah. I mean, I went back a bit traumatised because I had now experienced what it's like to fail, and it was terrible and it was painful, you know, and it had material impacts on everybody that was close to me that I look after. So it wasn't really a luxury that I allowed myself to think of whether this is the right time for it. It was just imperative, really, that I kind of got on with it. I think we're in a funny time, you know. I arrived back, I suppose, in the beginnings of austerity, and you know, which have now seen things like Brexit and Trumpistan happen, and the world is still very strange, and almost every excuse that there is to hesitate is now taken. So, I don't think I've arrived back with my kind of new business proposition, and in a time of plenty. And a time of fortune and a time of kind of loose spending. It's all pretty tight and competitive, and it's hand-to-hand combat every day for every piece of work that we get.
I don't know if you can put your finger on what is different now to what you did then, 20-odd, 30-odd years ago now. Much of the thinking, I'm sure, has changed in the world of branding and market research. Has a lot of it stayed the same?
I think some of the principal rules of brands continue to operate. I mean, the way I see it is pretty simple. You know, businesses exist and they make things, either services or products. Most of them discover that if you can apply a brand to those products or services, then that brand adds value. And as soon as you have a brand adding value, you need to manage the brand. Managing the brand brings in marketing, and marketing relies upon consumer intelligence to get it just right. So I understand the chain, and those things I don't think have really changed very much. What has changed is we have a much better understanding of the manner in which consumers relate and have relationships with brands. Mm. So we need much more subtle measures, which I've spent some time developing, and then we need much more subtle measurement systems, which again we've spent time developing. So, without getting too technical about it, neuroscientists have revealed to us that essentially a lot of our relationships are managed through our system one or instinctive or kind of just reflexive ways of thinking, and that we then explain and articulate thoughts around those through our system two powers of language. And what TX does is it measures the things which drive relationships between consumers and brands, which I can talk a bit more about if you like, and it captures those through a hybrid of your instinctive reactions and your thoughtful articulations. So we have come back with something really deeply different and much more sophisticated and contemporary than before, but the fundamental thing of a brand exists to increase the value of a business, that hasn't changed.
Let's hear your next track record choice. Ahead of that, Bob Dylan and Hurricane. Why this one, Nadeem?
Well, Mr. Nobel, reluctant Mr. Nobel, or coolly getting his Nobel Prize slowly, is just so great. I mean, I keep listening to his tracks and looking at his lyrics and surveying the way he conducts himself in life, and I just think, you know, this is just a living legend, and a bit like Muhammad Ali, you know, we should try and treasure him while he exists alive amongst us. Hurricane is a song of an injustice against a middleweight boxer called Reuben Carter that he sang in the 80s, I think, or maybe even the 70s. Not sure when the Desire album came out, but it was a long time ago. And it still resonates. It's still just a fantastic bit of storytelling.
Pistol shots ring out in a barroom night. Enter Betty Valentine from the upper hall. She sees a bartender in a pool of blood. Cries out, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell, but one time he could have been the champion of the world. Three bodies lying there, there's Patty C and another man named Bello moving around mysteriously. I didn't do what he says, and he throws up his hands. I was only robbing the register, I hope you understand. I saw him leave and he says, and he stops. One of us had better call up the cops. And so Patty calls the cops, and they arrive on the scene with their red lights flashing and the hot New Jersey night. Meanwhile, far away in another part of town, Reuben Carter and a couple of friends are driving around.
Nadeem Sadek joins us on this edition of Track Record on Share Radio, and amongst his choices, Hurricane by Bob Dylan. So in founding TX, it looks like you've maintained a good relationship with a number of the organisations that you'd worked with previously too. And does it give you great heart that these massive brands are still working with you a few decades on from your original company?
Yes, I have to say I've got a bit of ambivalence about it, because I kind of now see that there's an old world and a new world. We have offices principally in London and Durban in South Africa, where we process most of our information. But we also have client service centres in Jakarta in the east and San Francisco in the west. And the new world, you know, the tech-based, the Ubers, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters, you know, it's kind of an almost endless parade of names. They have been much more progressive about adopting new measures, new measurement, and a clearer way of understanding the impact of brands upon life and the way that people relate to them than some of the businesses that have had decades to practice this, but who I find are a bit mired in turgid relationships and a fear of change. That there's so much fear in so many people of losing their roles, that to kind of put your head above the parapet and say, I think we should try something truly innovative and different, without the guarantee that that will bring better value to the business for which you'll be rewarded as the bringer of that thing, it just has paralyzed many of the old world businesses. So, you know, I'm ambivalent about it. I'm enjoying the old worlds that take up the new. I'm loving the new world that takes up the new. And I'm a bit frustrated by quite a lot of the old world that just sits there and, you know, trudges on doing the same old stuff.
Let's see your next track record choice. It's Bob Marley. Why have you gone for this?
Of all musicians in the world, Bob Marley is my favourite. I think partly because, again, I lived in the West Indies and he was current at the time. I was also at school and listening to a lot of house music, I suppose, that came out in punk at the time. I think Bob Marley's ability to articulate political insanity and to have the courage to stand up to it was amazing. I was asked last week, you know, what did I think of the United debacle of throwing the doctor off the plane? And actually my greatest problem with it is the fact that nobody stopped those people, those security people, from dealing with a man like that. You know, why are we all so cowed and fearful of authority and being put on a terrorist list or whatever, of punishment, that we can't, when we see something humanly wrong, intervene and say, that's wrong? You know, Bob Marley did. He intervened in elections and he said the right things all the time.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. It is a war that until that day the dream of lasting peace.
Bob Marley. It's a track record choice from Nadeem Sadek, who's been with us on this edition of Track Record on Share Radio, and we'll come to your last in just a moment. But what is left yet to do in life or in business, Nadeem, for you?
I would love TX to fulfil its promise, which it's on its way to doing but hasn't yet achieved, and that's, you know, being a big new force in the industry. I would love Schaefer to succeed on a global scale. She's on her way to doing so. She's been brilliantly reviewed and is succeeding by any metric that you want to look at. I play around with motorbike reviews on Boss Bikes, and that's a lot of fun because I'm learning about production. I'm working with a young team of editors and directors and videographers. If I have one thing that I really want to do in my dotage, it's to return to what I used to love doing as an adolescent, which is writing. I've written some children's stories, and I think there's probably a darker piece of work still to emerge.
It's been a privilege and a pleasure to have spoken with you on Track Record, Nadeem. Tell us about your final track.
Well, atheist though I am, I love lots of spiritual music, and I suppose, you know, I shouldn't be surprised that it is beautiful because it's what matters so much to so many people. And I love, for example, that Gregorian chanting was, in truth, early trance music. This particular piece, Miserere Dei by Allegri, I find just the most tranquil and beautiful piece, and I often use it to sign out of a day.
Nadeem, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Track Record with Sue Dugan.